Recording has started. You may now proceed.
Great. Thank you, Zach. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the GNSO NextGen RDS PDP Working Group call on the 9th of August, 2016 at 1600 UTC. In the interest of time today, there will be no roll call as we have quite a few participants. Attendance will be taken via the Adobe Connect room. So if you're only on the audio bridge today, please let yourself be known now. All right, thank you. As a reminder, also all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Also keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll hand the call over to Chuck Gomes.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another NextGen RDS PDP Working Group call. Thank you for joining. I'm in a similar situation as to last week, where I'm in my small RV, so I will certainly try to mute when I'm not talking, but apologize in advance if there are any interruptions in that regard. I do seem to have good connectivity, so that's the plus. The roll call is in Adobe, as you can see. Does anyone have an SOI update to report? Not seeing any hands, and assuming that everyone's in Adobe, we'll move on from there. You can see the agenda on the right side of the Adobe screen, and if anybody has any questions or comments or suggestions on the agenda, now would be a good time to make those. Okay. Let's go ahead then and go to agenda item number two. And first of all, get a brief status on the problem statement. And my mind went blank. Was it Aiden that was going to give that statement or someone else?
Aiden and Alex Deacon are on the Adobe, so.
Thanks, Susan. This is Chuck. So do one of you want to jump in, and you can both speak if you'd like. Tell us the status of the development of a possible working group problem statement. Go ahead, Aiden.
Thanks, Chuck. Hi, everyone. This is Aiden Federline. I apologize. I wasn't on the call last Friday, so I can't speak to what was discussed then, but my understanding from the email threads, which I've followed since, is that Mark has produced an updated problem statement which blends together the two earlier competing statements which we had previously been working off. And earlier today, Alex emailed through just some minor revisions to that statement. I think we're on the right track now. Basically that we as a working group have been tasked with coming up with problems that are associated with making sure that the RDS is fit for purpose A's and the future's ever-evolving internet. I might just leave it there, but Alex, do you agree with my assessment or do you want to expand upon what I just said?
Thanks, Aiden. Can everyone hear me? This is Alex.
Yes.
Yeah, Aiden, that's right. I guess the only thing I'd like to add is that we did ask the leadership for one more week to finish this up. We weren't able to wrap things up as a subgroup in time to send this to the full working group. So we've asked and generously received one more week to put the final touches on it. But I agree with Aiden that I think we now have a statement that's agreeable to most in the group or all in the group, and we'll work hard to publish it to the full group as soon as we can. Thanks.
Thanks to both of you and to all of you who have contributed to the work going on there. This is Chuck speaking again, and we'll look forward to seeing something hopefully before our next meeting so that we can talk about that. Any questions or comments to Alex or Aiden, or any comments by anyone else working on this statement? Mark, please go ahead. You may be on mute, Mark. We're not hearing anything.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Now we can. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. I'm sorry. I had trouble connecting again, because I was using the wrong browser in the plugin, blah, 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 blah. So I missed what was just mentioned. If you could summarize, I'll let you know if there's additional information on the problem statement. The updated problem statement, it was updated again on Sunday, and we think with one more week, you know, another meeting on Friday, that we should be able to close it out.
This is Chuck. That's consistent, Mark, with what Aiden and Alex said. And,
okay,
again, appreciate the good work.
To reiterate.
Okay. Any other comments? Is that an old hand, Mark? Okay, it's gone. Thanks. All right. Let's go then to a brief update on the triage document. And I'll let Lisa give that update. Lisa, please.
Thanks, Chuck. This is Lisa Pfeiffer for the record. We actually have several activities that are continuing in parallel on possible requirements and triage. The first is completing the outstanding assignments. We have just a few people still left that had volunteered to collect possible requirements from key input documents. And I think those of you who have outstanding assignments know who you are. We may need some help in backfilling on the documents that are associated with internationalized registration data. I'm maybe reaching out to some of you to see experience in internationalized registration data. We could definitely use a volunteer to pick up those assignments and get those possible requirements together. The second activity then is gathering the additional possible requirements and adding them to draft 4 of the ongoing document, now in triaged format. And then the third activity is actually going through the triaged document and applying.
You're breaking up a little bit, Lisa, so we're missing part of what you're saying. And we're hearing nothing right now. Okay. Don't know if we lost Lisa. So with regard to volunteers as she requested. Certainly, if you're interested in helping on that, please send a message to the list, and we appreciate your contributions in that regard. Marika, please go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika. This reflects Lisa. I'll try to fill in. I think she was on the last part on the work on triage, and I think I presume she was going to say that, but that's still a work that is in progress. We now have the list of definition of the keywords as submitted by Susan, as well as the additional definitions from Stephanie. So that is work that further will need to be reconciled, and that's still in progress. So we'll hope to report in further detail on that during next week's call.
Thank you very much, Marika. I don't know if Lisa has rejoined us. Lisa, if you have, please speak up.
Can you hear me now?
We can. Go ahead.
My apologies. I think my line may be flaky, but I think Marika actually captured just fine the third activity that was in progress.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions or comments? All right, let's move on to the main part of our agenda and continue to review example use cases. And the first one we have today is number 13, services required by registry agreement. And Maxim Alzoba submitted that one. And just like last week, Maxim, I'd like you to give just a brief overview of your case to give people enough background to participate in discussion about your use case. Maxim, you're up.
Hello, everybody. Maxim Alzoba for the record. Do you hear me?
Yes, we hear you fine.
Okay. Short overview. We have a category of use cases which fall into, like, required by the registry agreement. What does it mean? We have few pre-authorized parties, like URS providers, UDRP providers, registry data escrow providers, yeah, and I can audit. Usually they don't do it themselves. They use help of KPMG or someone like them. And where this party requires access to probably all fields of some records, or maybe for the escrow to all fields of all records registry creates in the RDS. So the short version is we know who will access the data, we know particular reason, because in each case of URS or UDRP, it's documented what they're looking for. They look for the date of when it was, the domain was registered by whom, which flags are set, etc., etc. Also, the process, URS process, requires registry operator to set certain EPP statuses and the URS provider's checks, because it's an obligation of a registry to do so under URS procedure rules and technical part of URS rules. The same, almost, also similar things happens under UDRP process. And if we talk about the escrow operator, it's a daily process, and under the contract with the registry, the registry escrow provider has to verify data. Usually it's just basic sanity check that, for example, we don't upload data with no cities in the fields or empty registrant fields or something. Also, they do, it's not disclosed in the contract, but it says that they have to verify records, and if something is wrong with the upload from the registry, they have to check what went wrong, and most probably it will require check what's in their servers to compare it with the contents of the RDS. And the last thing is I can audit, or the company which was allowed to do audit for them this time, the ideas why they want to check records and which records they want to check, it changes every time, because one day they check how many fax fields were not empty. The other day they think that some particular registration had some minor violations of some policies, and they have to investigate what went where and how. So basically all these four cases, they might be split into two cases, where the first is URS and UDRP, because from one hand, it's the legal framework, not legal, but anyway, it's something similar to the litigation process. But from the other hand, it's the known finite list of parties, which all of them are pre-authorized by ICANN to act, to fulfill their roles. And, basically that's it. I hope it wasn't long. Thanks.
Thank you, Maxime. This is Chuck. And be prepared to respond to questions that people may have. I'm going to start the discussion off before I give it to Steve. Just a clarification point for everyone, Maxime. Do the providers have the same access that the public has, or are they given different access under the registry agreements? And maybe a corollary question is, do they have to contact the registry before they get the access? Could you just explain that a little bit for everybody's benefit?
For this case, each of these four types of parties, they have contracts on hand which clearly say what they can and cannot do. Because, as I understand, URS and UDRP providers, they have some kind of contract with ICANN, and definitely it's not the same level of access as public is going to have. The registry escrow provider, they have one contract with the registry, and I think they have another contract with ICANN. So, and of course, the company which makes audit, registry audit for ICANN, they have contracts for this kind of access, and I assume that all these four kinds of parties, they have NDAs in place, and their contracts say what they can access and what they have to do with the data after the process. As I understand, for example, audit companies, they have to destroy information in some period of time, quite short period of time, after the audit of particular registry. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you, Maxime. Appreciate that. Steve Metallitz, you're up, please.
Yes, thank you. Steve Metallitz speaking. Thank you, Maxime, for preparing this this example. One question I had is where, looking at the URS and UDRP examples, is where does the complaining party, the complainant in the UDRP or URS case fit into this? I would think they would at least be another stakeholder that ought to be listed, but it just strikes me that they certainly need access to some of this same information in order to prepare and initiate the case. I don't know whether that falls outside of this example and would be in a different use case, but since you were talking about the URS and UDRP procedures, I guess my question is why the access by the UDRP or URS complainant is not included here. Thank you.
Thanks, Maxime. Thanks, Steve. Maxime, did you want to respond?
Yes. The short version. I think I forgot to add registrant to the other stakeholders because he might be affected because his data is going to be disclosed to someone. But in the registry agreement, registry require from registrar that they have consent for processing of data. So I'm not sure if registrant should be added there. And the complaint and the party which files the case under URS or UDRP, I suggest they use the public access use case where they have equal rights as any other member of public or any other third party in the internet. And these third party, they don't have any contractual obligations with registry or ICANN, so they don't fit this, I think. They might be affected, but they cause the request. They're not the part of the case. That's what I think. Thanks.
Thanks, Maxine. Let's go to Alan.
Thank you very much. A couple of points. On the escrow operator, I've never looked into this, but I always presumed that the escrow operator had to confirm that they have received data, but they don't actually look at the contents of the data. I don't even know if it's encrypted that when they get it or not. So I'm presuming the escrow operator does not necessarily and perhaps does not at all have actual access to the contents of the data, but that's something that someone who's in the business could perhaps confirm. With regard to the UDRP, and I don't know if it's the same with the URS, one of the curious things is that when the reveal is asked for, when the registrar is asked to who is the registrant, clearly if it's a proxy service, the proxy is the proxy provider is the registrant. Many proxy providers do not want to assume any liability for misuse of a domain that's registered through them, and therefore their contracts allow them to reveal the name of the real registrant in a UDRP. And if they do, the UDRP provider, again, if I remember correctly from a number of PDPs I've worked on, is required at the end of the process to reveal who is the original registrant. In other words, to unmask the registrant if the proxy provider provided them with the information. So that adds another flavor to this that is not normally discussed. You know, if someone, for instance, files a potentially frivolous UDRP site, that could end up with the proxy registrant, the real registrant, being revealed by the proxy provider. So it adds an interesting twist to the concept of confidential data with regard to proxies. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan, for that good information. And note, there's been some answers with regard to the escrow provider in the chat that I think are pretty helpful in that regard. Lisa, your turn.
Thanks, Chuck. Lisa Pfeiffer for the record. Just listening to Alan's question and also Steve's, it occurs to me that this may really be three use cases that are intertwined here because there are different actors involved in the three contractual requirements, URS, UDRP, audit, and then escrow. And also to Steve's point, there's perhaps a variant use case or very related, closely related use case where the complainant initiates the URS and or UDRP. My question to Maxim is it possible to identify more specifically the data that each of those stakeholders actually needs and if it comes from the who is today?
Maxim Azoba, I will answer the first question about, Ron Allen, about the escrow operator. In the contract, it has wording verify, and also the keys to the encrypted files are sent with the file, so they can, or if I'm not mistaken, they have it from the beginning of the process. So the encryption works only for safe transfer of the data, and so they actually have access to all these fields. And if you look through the contract with the registry and the escrow operator, and it's available on the ICANN website, it has wording verify in two places. Yeah, so they have to do it. And the only way to verify contents is to compare it directly. Anyway, they have the one-day-old information, so it doesn't change much. And The second question about splitting this case into use case into three, it could be done because what is common is that these parties have pre-authorization, they are accredited, and we know who they are and we know what they're going to do with which set of data. But if you feel strongly that this use case should be split into two, like URS and UDRP to the left, and SQL operator and our audit to the right, or maybe into three, it could be done. Also, I must mention that registrars might have something similar. So because I didn't ruffle through the registrar agreement, accreditation agreement, but they might have something which they have to do and which requires some particular parties to have access to the data. And about affected stakeholders, I'm not really good with UDRP. We might need help of someone who was a panelist or like passed through this pain a few times, so he knows things. Thanks.
Thank you, Maxime. And notice that, again, there's continually good and helpful chat going on with regard to proxy and privacy services, et cetera. So I'll let everybody watch that on your own. Any other questions or comments on this one? And keep in mind, our goal is not to produce use cases, rather to use the use cases to understand the various possible uses and users and requirements that we'll be deliberating on in the not-too-distant future. And I think that this discussion is doing a good job of making sure the working group understands the various issues as related to this particular set of use cases. Any other questions or comments? Alan, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to clarify one thing I said. The reveal by the privacy proxy holder to the UDRP panel is not necessarily problematic. The problematic part is that the provider is required in the final public documents they create to say who the original registrant is, even if the case has been found against the person who filed the UDRP. So that means the information is potentially revealed even though the person hasn't done anything which is deemed to be inappropriate, and therefore is a way of essentially getting around any privacy issues. And that's the part that I think we're going to have to be sensitive to as we go forward. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. And again, Cal, thanks for responding to Max in the chat. And so all that's really good information for us as we prepare for deliberation in a few weeks. Anything else before we move to the next use case? Okay. The next one on our list is number 16, the who is misused to shame, anger, or scare a registrant. And Aidan, if you would give us a brief overview of that, I would appreciate that. Go ahead.
Thanks, Chuck. This is Aidan Bertolin for the record. So the misuse case that I introduced was where the existing who is protocol is misused with the intention of angering, scaring, or shaming a domain name registrant. And this can happen where a person or group of persons enter the WHOIS protocol to obtain personally identifiable information associated with a domain name registrant and then circulates this information widely, perhaps on Reddit or on Twitter or on another platform, with the intention of causing real and substantial harm to the victim with with no obvious benefits or gains to the attacker. And this is not a purely hypothetical situation, because people like Randy Harper have already been the victim of doxing as a direct consequence of the WHOIS protocol being misused. So in order to prevent this misuse transpiring as we move forward, in this misuse case, I suggested that no personally identifiable information be stored in the RDS whatsoever, because the only data elements that the RDS require are the domain name itself, the registrar, the domain name's expiry date, and its status as registered or not registered. And they also noted that for it to be a functional use, as I believe it was Andrew who suggested a few months ago on our mailing list, there are two optional fields, the name service and the auth code. If there are any questions about this misuse case, I'd be happy to try to respond to them.
Thanks, Aidan. This is Chuck. And keep in mind, we're not at a point where we're deciding what fields should be stored or revealed or whatever. That will be part of our deliberation later on. But questions and discussion on this use case are welcome now. Steve Metallitz, you're first.
Yes, thank you. This is Steve. My only question was about, I mean, there's one sentence in here I didn't understand, and that is the second sentence in the story about repeating the process to obtain information about the registrant's friends or family. I just wondered if you could explain a little more detail what activity you're talking about there. Would this only be if the friends or family were also domain name registrants, or just how would this relate to the registration data? Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. That's correct. So that would only be if the friends or family also were a domain name registrant, and it was and their details were in the RDS to be taken as well.
Thanks, Steve, for the question and the response, Aidan. Steve, did you have a follow up?
No, I just was trying to understand how that would fit in, and I guess that would be I don't know how frequently that would be the case that it would be apparent from what was publicly available who the friends and family were, and you could check to see if they had domain names. So I just don't I'm not sure how common that would be, but I think I understand that there might in some cases be that scenario. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve. Andrew, go ahead.
Thanks. There is this suggestion, and I guess this has cropped up in a couple of use cases where what we've got is a use case, and then we've got a claim about what the consequences of the use case ought to be. And it seems to me to be useful to separate that, because it doesn't seem to me that it follows from this case that, which I guess is an anti-use case, that the RDEDS shouldn't have any of this data. It rather suggests that there are limits to how widely it should be shared and so on. And those seem to me to be very different conclusions that come from the same premise.
Thanks, Andrew. Chuck again. Stephanie, go ahead.
Hi, thanks, Stephanie Perrin. For the record, I was just responding to Steve Metallitz's question about the parents, because I did have a conversation with a girl who was a victim of doxing back in the PPSAI days. And she said she, because of who was a change in address, she had to contact her parents to warn them that their address when she was a kid, she was living at home with her parents when she got her first website, and they had tracked back to her parents. So she had to warn them that some idiot would possibly come by and shoot up the house or whatever they were doing. The degree of violence that goes on in these doxing things, I must say, I find rather shocking. Anyway, that's a sideline. Thanks.
Thanks, Stephanie. Mark, your turn.
Yeah, so 2 points there. Just to pile on to the original use case and then Stephanie's comment, I was once indirectly doxxed by some right-wing Nazi fools because I have a very unusual last name. So the concept of I can look up somebody else's family in the RDS, I think that, you know, if my name is Chuck Jones, that would be pretty hard. If your name is Mark Shansierek, then it's not so hard, you know. So they were looking for my son, and they found me. So it's a real thing. I think it's limited to certain classes of names, of course, which doesn't make it any less severe, because they did say that they would do all sorts of horrible things, which, of course, they didn't. Then secondly, to Andrew's point, again, let's keep remembering that there's different information that is applicable to different people in the value chain, and they may have different privacy policy and access policy applied to them on a datum-by-datum basis when we get this all sorted out. So as Andrew says, good to think about. This information may be perfectly valid and perfectly safe in this one place, but not perfectly valid and perfectly safe in another place. That doesn't mean the use case isn't valid, but as we're thinking through the process and policy implications of it, that's good to keep in mind.
Thanks, Mark. Lisa, go ahead.
Thanks, Chuck. Lisa Pfeiffer for the record. And actually, Mark set me up quite well because I just wanted to point everyone to a link that I placed in the chat about a Who is Misuse study that was done. At this point, it was done a few years ago, but a study that was done to try to examine what kinds of data in Who is are misused, the extent to which they're misused, and then also try to assess the impact on the registrant of that misuse. And that study looked at misuse from a couple of different angles, both trying to collect real-world cases and examples of misuse from first responders and law enforcement around the world, and then also trying to simulate by registering some domain names, which proved a little bit tougher in terms of, you know, actually providing a juicy target for misuse. But in any event, I still think it's a useful study to think about, to take a look at and think about, because it looks at what specific data elements are abused or misused and its impact. And just to give you an example of that, all of us get spam. Email addresses get misused quite frequently, but that seemed to be a relatively not impactful kind of misuse, because we all have spam filters. Whereas when phone numbers get misused, they have a higher impact. So, and that's just one example of kind of teasing out what the impact is of misuse of specific data elements as input to policy discussions in the future.
Thanks, Lisa. Your turn, Alan.
Thank you. I certainly don't want to get into the discussion of what we should be doing in a future RDS, but I do question the statement that no personally identifying information is needed in the RDS. Certainly for issues related to domain renewal, hijacking, transfer, and a number of other things, there needs to be information available to other than the original registrar. In many cases, certainly the original registrar has all sorts of information so they can run their business. But there needs to be information available to other parties in this game to handle a whole host of issues that can come up. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Again, this discussion, in my opinion, is, and this is Chuck speaking, is really helpful in helping us all see the competing issues that we will be dealing with when we get into deliberation and start trying to reach consensus on some recommendations for requirements. One of the things I'd like to encourage everybody to do, and maybe even before I say that, let me say that I've been impressed the way everybody, for the most part, has really adjusted and has tried to avoid getting ahead of ourselves and start deliberating and arguing cases and so forth. I've been very pleased over the last couple of weeks how people are starting to monitor that on their own, and you don't need me to chime in and remind you. So thanks for that. That's very much appreciated. The second thing I wanted to encourage everyone to do, first of all, let me preface what I'm going to say next by saying that we want everybody to avidly defend their points of view in our discussions. We need that. But also, I'd like you to balance that with trying to understand, and I think we're seeing that happening in discussion of use cases, others' points of view and other needs that are different than yours and that may compete with you, yours, because that balanced view is what's going to help us to find solutions, hopefully, that we can maximize the benefits to everyone. So please try to continue to do that. Again, I've been pleased with the way it's going. Sorry for the background noise. And Alan, your hands up, so please go ahead.
Sorry, that was an old hand.
Okay, Alan, and again, sorry for the interruptions. Any other questions or comments on this case? Okay. Then let's go to the next one. And scrolling back up the agenda here, number 12, the trademark infringement. And Mark, you're up. Go ahead and give us a brief overview.
Okay. is it being shared, or do I need to provide my own copy of it?
I think they're going to bring it. They're bringing it up right now.
Sure it is. I see it now. Okay, great. All right, so the main goal is a corporate employee attempting to prevent misuse of her corporation's brands and trademarks. And the summary of it is that by various means, both reactive and proactive, people and organizations who misuse a trademark online can be identified in order to ask them to cease and desist. And RDS lookups are usually where this process starts. So in this case, the primary actor will be a trademark attorney at a company whose marks are being infringed, but people who will be involved or entities that will be involved include the registrant, the registrar, maybe a privacy proxy service. And the scope will involve other companies who are potentially being infringed by the same entities and maybe even outside counsel. So the data elements that here, I'm going to jump ahead. Sorry, I never really figured out the template, and I didn't go back and fix it either. So let's imagine that Terry is working in the legal and corporate affairs division of a prominent brand holding corporation, and she receives information very frequently from the individual businesses that comprise her company. So there's a big company; it has many products and services organized into many businesses, and by various means, they find out that people are infringing, and so they can inform her of the sites which are violating the trademarks or maybe the licensing terms of her company in the domain name string or the contents. And this happens several times a week. Now, Terry, besides relying on just serendipitous finding of these sites, also has a tool that she's licensing from a third party, and that's scraping around the internet doing DNS searches, doing web searches, and applying AI-based analytics. So all of this is going on in parallel besides the reactive responses that she's getting from her various business organizations within the company. So when the infringing sites are identified, she uses a reverse whois to identify other sites that may be tied to the registrant. And we did discuss in an earlier use case that sometimes bad actors are not very clever at covering up their tracks. And so you'll find that they're doing multiple bad things in multiple places, and doing a reverse whois is a good way to find them. And sometimes they're not just doing bad things to Terry's company, they're doing it to other companies. And so just as a professional courtesy, she may have someone in her company inform them of this, you know, just to let them know. So that we and hopefully they do the same for her. Now, if they can be identified and then contact using this RDS data, a cease and desist order may be sent. Maybe the communication will be less formal than that. Sometimes a UDRP is filed so that we can, so that Terry's company can reclaim the infringing domain, but often the information is not correct or it's incomplete, or maybe it's hidden behind a privacy proxy service. And in that case, Terry will contact the registrar and probably contact outside counsel too. And this is because frequently these notifications either are unproductive or take a lot of extra effort. And this may also spawn additional investigations online to determine the identity of the infringing party. So I have two variations of the story. One of them is that the RDS data falsely identifies her company as the registrant, and so a UDRP would not be appropriate, and Terry will work directly with the registrar. Another variation is that it's not the domain name itself that's infringing, it's the content on the site. So this is sort of on the edge of the domain name system, I guess. You know, people who are more well-informed could tell me whether or not this is really a domain name problem or something else. But in my example, Pirates R Us might be impersonating her company and then using her trademark on the site to offer, say, unauthorized software downloads, which may or may not include malware, which makes it a digital crime as opposed to simply a trademark violation. In those cases, cease and desist won't change the registrant's behavior. Terry must work directly with the registrar, and since this is not specifically part of the domain name system and is not covered by the same contract, the success rate is actually pretty low. So the privacy implications, as I see them, I'm going to roll back to the data elements. So this is a little bit boilerplate. She's looking for data elements that allow communication in real or near real time, email addresses, IM addresses, telephone number, things like that. The privacy implications are that data are being collected and stored according to Terry's corporate privacy policy, which is based on, hopefully, good privacy principles such as collect only what you need, use it only for what you need, and then keep it for only as long as you need. And this privacy policy will probably be distinct from the public privacy policy that Terry's customer gets. So most large corporations publish a privacy policy that tell you, you know, which data they collect from their customers, what they do with it, et cetera. This privacy policy would be an internal risk management privacy policy, probably not published. It would be subject to the legal and corporate affairs, you know, group at the company, but different. Who has control and access to the data? So Terry's company, of course, is collecting and accessing the data that they require to perform these functions. They do this in a way that it is secure, and only a limited number of employees have access to it, and that makes the risk of it escaping their security boundary less. But the data will be shared with the registries, with outside counsel, with law enforcement on a case-by-case basis, and the outside counsel would be held accountable to the company privacy and data handling policy. These other parties would not. So the scope of this use case, you know, once you hand it off to law enforcement, they're going to do what they're going to do. And so these data will be available when the registrars are in compliance, when the information is complete and accurate, when the privacy proxies are not in use. And how the data can be accessed. So there's various implementations of who is, of course. Some of this will be manual. Some of this will be automated. And then there are some questions. Would you like me to address those directly?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. So Andrew has some good comments. Lisa asks, are the data elements of the registrant, admin contact, tech contact, or all of those? I think it's, you know, I don't have the specific detail on what Terry uses right now specifically. I imagine she collects everything that's available and then uses whatever she feels is appropriate. Steve makes a comment that not sure that the ultimate success rate in variant 2 is relevant. It was merely a comment to show the challenges that are related to using this data, that you know, that sometimes the success is limited. It's more of a interesting data point, I think.
Thank you very much, Mark. Fabricio, you've had your hand up for a while. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks, Chuck. Fabricio Bayer for the record. So, yeah, I just wanted to suggest along the lines of what's going on in the chat with regard to data elements. When doing trademark infringement analysis, whether it be about the domain name or on the site, you're going to need more data elements than just the contactability data elements. We've talked about this at the EWG, but you really do need to get into who it is, where they are, and for how long they've been at it, meaning how long they've registered the domain and used it. All that goes into whether there's an infringement or not, because trademarks are based, obviously, on use, types of goods, channels of trade, geographic regions. So without all that, you're basically just shooting in the dark and sending a letter based on mere kind of identical or confusingly similar look of a mark, but you don't really have a basis for infringement unless it's just absolutely blatantly obvious. So I would just suggest that we need more data elements put into the use case. Otherwise, very good. Thank you.
Thanks, Fabricio. Other questions or comments? And again, I'll let you, everybody, watch the chat. There's great discussion going on there as well. Certainly, if anybody wants to speak up on any of those things, just raise your hand, and you're welcome to do so. Stephanie.
Yeah, thanks, Stephanie Perrin, for the record. I just wanted to point out that if you're operating in a jurisdiction that has data protection law, the odds are quite good that those internal policies that you might want to protect in your legal department, certain elements of the conditions for release to law enforcement, to, you know, those alleging infringement, et cetera, might have to be made available under an openness and disclosure policy to the individual whose personal information we're talking about here. So I just wanted to put that on the record there. Thanks.
Yeah,
thank
Mark,
you, Stephanie.
Absolutely right.
Identify yourself and say that again, please.
That was Mark again, and I agree with Stephanie that since the variety of data access and privacy laws, there's a wide variety around the world, and so in some cases, you may need to contact people, you may need to publish those privacy policies. A large corporation like Terry's has a large organization that makes sure that they're in compliance with all these laws. Smaller operators may or may not be compliant to all these things.
Thanks for responding, Mark. I appreciate that. Any other discussion on this case, if not, let's go to the next one. Again, thanks for all the all of you who are jumping in the discussion, both in the chat and audibly. So the next one is the number 8, the real world contact. And for Vishio, that's yours. So if you'd give us a overview of that as they're bringing it up, that would be appreciated.
Sure. Thanks, Chuck. Fabrice Vire for the record. So this use case comes from real world in that it spawned from something I was actually doing during the EWG. The scenario is very simple, which is that someone, a consumer, goes online to purchase something, does a search for a part or good, service, et cetera. They get a bunch of search results for various websites offering presumably the same part but for different price points. The consumer goes to the lowest price point that is on a website that's unfamiliar to them. They don't recognize the brand. Or if they do recognize the brand, they want to verify that it's the website offering is actually from that brand, store, et cetera, that they recognize. So what they do is they go and they check the RDS to confirm that who they're about to do business with is actually who they think they're going to do business with, or someone that seems reputable to them. When I did this back in the day, I was looking for a part to replace the burners on my gas grill. I got a bunch of websites. Something seemed really great. I honestly did not know who this company was. It wasn't like a Sears or a Home Depot or something like that. So I just went to check to see, you know, does this look like a reputable company, someone that I could contact or double check, or am I just kind of putting my credit card info into a website that is going to either steal my info or go into a black hole? And the alternative or play on this use case is that it's not just for consumers who may be looking to interact with a website commercially, but also a consumer who may have already interacted with a website commercially is unable to identify contact information on the website when they have a problem either with deliveries, returns, what have you, and wants to go ahead and check to see if there's either alternative information they can use to contact the vendor or just contact that they can't find on the website. That covers, I think, the goal in the scenario. The primary actors, obviously, is the consumer looking for online goods and services. Put down that the stakeholders are obviously the RDS, the person or entity associated with the registered domain name, the validator, if we're having those, I assume we are, the registrar and registry who collect the data initially to give to the RDS. And they're all stakeholders, obviously, because they have to, a person has to give up their information to the registrar and the registry, and then it goes into the RDS. The scope here is interacting with the RDS. The level is a user level. Put down that the data elements here really is, since we're verifying ownership, and for communication in real time, would be the registrant name, address, and contact details, email and phone number. Let's see. I put down privacy implications here, and Stephanie, you and I had an exchange about this last call. Put that there should be no privacy implications in this context based on the fact that many jurisdictions, and Stephanie, as you mentioned, good practices for companies doing commercial to list their, identify themselves physical address. This obviously makes the assumption that it's not a company forcing an individual to put their own information out there or that that individual has consented to it. So happy to qualify that based on our prior conversation. And who has control? Obviously the registrant supplies the data, the registry and registrar maintain it, and the display of the data or warehousing of data, at least based on the EWG discussions we had in the past, would be the RDS. And then conditions under which that data is accessible today and how you access the data today. There are no restrictions, and it's easy to access in today's world. and obviously up for deliberation at some point, whether and based on the prior discussions we just had with Aiden and Andrew and Alan, whether there's a discussion about restrictions on display, EWG called this gating. So that's it. Happy to address any questions if anyone has any.
Thanks, Servicio. Alan, go ahead. You can be first.
Thank you very much. Two comments. First of all, there have been some comments in the chat saying not too many people know to do this, and that's probably true on a relative scale. But that's not the same as the information couldn't be used in this way. If for instance, someone came up with an app, with an application, a website, which says, identify who your seller is here, put in their domain address, their URL, and we'll tell you who owns the company. Suddenly that information might be used by a much larger number of consumers if the provider is good, does a good job at publicizing their new service. But it raises an interesting question. If we set up ultimately a system where you cannot get this information available, then consumers who either through their own volition or through this kind of service want to check on who it is they're dealing with will not be able to. So as long as the information can be there, it may well be to the advantage of the seller to make sure their information is there so they pass the test for those who choose to go to that level of testing. But if we set up rules so no one's information is ever in the RDS, then we are prohibiting this method of verification. Thank you.
Chuck, can I weigh in on what Alan just said? This is Bruce.
Yes, go ahead, Fabricio.
Yes, I just want to thank you, Alan. I recognize that this isn't something that, all consumers do or know of. As I mentioned, I actually did this myself. I've done it now twice. I've done it for automobile parts, which is what I updated this to, and grill parts. And then I do it for various reasons. My mom gets emails from solicitors. But to Alan's point, one of the things that was proposed back at the EWG stage was whether, just like websites now will tell you if things are locked or secure, you would be able to hover over the browser, and that would just tie in via an API to the RDS. And we didn't explore that, but as far as technology goes on this area, it could be something that you could hover over, and instead of getting a red or a green, or a lock on the browser, you'd actually be able to hover over and it would give you the who is information. So it'd be horrible to cut that access off and the possibility for that technology.
Thanks for every show. Andrew, go ahead and jump in.
Oh, there we go. Thank you. I was pushing back a little bit on this in the chat, but I want to press a little bit harder because I think people are collapsing two things here, and it's really important not to collapse them because there is a seriously dangerous corner that people are opening here, and they may not realize it. When you get an EV certificate, an extended validation certificate from a certificate authority, and I am not an apologist for the certificate authorities, so don't please interpret this as some sort of suggestion that they really know what they're doing. What that has done is it's validated actually the control of the server that you're talking to. So when you make an HTTPS connection, you validate the connection over TLS, and so you're actually validating that you're talking to the server that you ought to be. And the thing about EV certificates is that they're supposed to validate somehow that server is under the control of the person that it's supposed to be, so under the control of the certificate issuer. The RDS doesn't tell you that. What the RDS tells you is who registered the domain name and actually who registered the domain name above the domain name that you're talking to a lot of the time. So very frequently, for instance, we are using right now icann.adobeconnect.com, and what would happen is we would get an RDS answer from this that is about adobeconnect.com and not about icann.adobeconnect.com. The danger here is that what you would do is train users to believe that there is a tight relationship between who controls the domain name under which a name is being operated and every website underneath that domain name. And I think that that is dangerous. I see Alex Deacon is saying in the chat that not all websites use EV certs, and I completely agree. But what I'm arguing here is that we don't want to make this worse. So in fact, I don't believe that consumers should really be encouraged to do the kind of thing that people are talking about here, because it can lead you astray. If you are, you know, sufficiently understanding of the relationship between a domain name and the URL that you're using, then perhaps the RDS gives you the kind of information that you would like here. But I actually think that this is a dangerous use case, and I'm not particularly convinced that we ought to pursue it.
Thanks, Andrew. Stephanie.
Thanks, Stephanie Perrin, for the record. I'll try not to repeat what Andrew said. Obviously, I cannot make the same technical claims, but I would just like to say that I did do a random sample when I was giving a speech a couple of years ago during the EWG, and this was an informed audience at a privacy conference with senior bureaucrats who ought to, if anybody would understand what who is, was, and almost nobody put up their hand when I asked the question, do you use this? So that, I find that heartening because, first of all, I think that there's a risk that we will discriminate against smaller companies who are using privacy proxy services and hosting providers who do all the registration and all the work for them and offer them turnkey systems. It's not clear at all that their data is going to be in the RDS. Obviously, it'll be somewhere, but it won't be right in the public end of the RDS, so that a consumer would look up Steph's homemade quilt, not find it registered to somebody called Steph, and say, oh, this must be a scam. Now, given that consumers are pretty well left on their own figuring out what's a scam these days and what the heck their browser is supposed to tell them and what the heck the problem with certs is, I would just like to put the caveat that if we're going to actually expand on this and provide who is data in certs, and I would argue it's not within ICANN's mandate to start messing with the browsers, there's a massive consumer education campaign that has to be done. So who's going to do that? Because governments have not stepped up to the plate. Thanks.
Thanks, Stephanie. Rod.
Sorry, my phone was giving me problems trying to unmute here. Just a couple of things of interest, I think, on this current discussion thread. One of the things we had talked about in the EWG is actually creating potentially a contact for cert authorities to use. So that's in the documentation somewhere, because the CAB form is really the responsible party for promotion of certs and how that works and all that. So I'll leave it to them, I think, to handle the worldwide education effort there. The one thing I do want to point out, though, is that, and perhaps we need a use case to talk about this. I know we did talk about this in EWG, but it's become even more prevalent since that time, is that people are using information like Whois to create reputation to data and services that then go out and rank, you know, how trustworthy is a website, like a web of trust and places like that. Those become part of an application or an add-in to your browser or part of your scoring metric for your email, whether or not it's marked spam, et cetera. And those are all using Whois information. If there's something that is protected by privacy proxy services, those are usually downgraded as less trustworthy. There are correlations done between domains that have been seen before doing dodgy things that have been new domains using that same registration information will also be downgraded as far as reputation. So you're less likely to be finding that in a search, more likely to be finding a warning attached to that, or less likely to receive an email from that domain name if it's got a sketchy reputation based on those kinds of factors. So this stuff does, you know, it's kind of tangential to this, what started here, but it was, it's certainly part of what we're talking about in this conversation thread. So we may want to take a look at that as well.
Thank you very much, Rod. This is Chuck again. And just to set Karnika and others' minds at ease, we're not eliminating any possible use cases at this stage, okay? It's okay to suggest that it maybe should be, but we'll decide that later. So please understand that. And any other discussion on this use case before we move on? Okay. The next one, I think, is from one of our vice chairs. So, number 15, fraudulent contact information. Susan?
Thanks, Chuck. This is a current issue that we're facing. So, two domain names were registered and recently, just in July, and used on our site in a fraud phishing scam. So targeting our users, they registered com-video.net and login-account.net and used all of Facebook information completely throughout. So it looks very much, if you look at the Facebook.com registration, it looks exactly the same Whois record except the servers. So they control the servers, and, you know, technically they shouldn't control the domain name because domain at fb.com is the admin email of record on the registration. But so basically this is all valid information. It's not inaccurate, but it is inaccurate for the registrant that used it, because they do not have the right to basically steal Facebook's corporate identity. And so, to, you know, once we saw these domain names were being, we detected them, then, you know, Whois lookup was done, and, you know, surprise, surprise, but it's not a surprise. This kind of thing happens frequently. It is, you know, we found our information on the Whois record, and so therefore a registrar accepted this information because it is accurate, but it's fraudulent use, and so therefore I would contend it's inaccurate information because the registrant didn't have the right. So basically it's all the stakeholders would be the registry, registrar, third-party Whois service providers, in general, just interacting with a domain name directory service, and it's all the entity name, email address, name servers, postal address, phone number, creation date, which is really critical in doing investigation for these. It's like, how long has this domain name been around? So what has it done? What has it been used for? And also the last update is also critical. We see this quite frequently, sometimes just out of somebody just thinks it's fun. Other times, in this case, where we know they were attempting to do bad things, we were able to stop that. But, you know, the struggle continues with convincing a registrar that it is inaccurate information for that registrant, and then gaining control of the domain name. And that's about it.
Thanks, Susan. Chuck again. Questions or comments on this use case? Several people are typing, so we'll watch that. Anybody want to ask a question audibly or make a comment? Please raise your hand. Lisa, go ahead.
Hello?
We can't hear you, Lisa.
Sorry, on mute. This is Lisa Pfeiffer for the record, and the point that I wanted to raise about this use case is that, if I'm understanding correctly, it's not that the data itself was invalid. In fact, it is valid. It just belongs to someone else. And the reason that this is possible today is that anyone can enter anyone's data in Whois. Is that correct?
Correct. So, you could enter Mickey Mouse. That's a valid character, Disney character. And so it is a valid name, or in this case, Facebook. And so it is not invalid or inaccurate information, but it is a fraudulent, in my opinion, a fraudulent and inaccurate use by that registrant. Because it does not identify the registrant of the domain name, it identifies the company that they were targeting for their bad with their bad behavior. And just as a side note and anecdotal, and doesn't really have anything to do with this, you would not believe how many registrars I've had this argument with. So, and just in the current scheme of things, there is an email validation requirement, and that was never done here. So, because that would have come directly to me.
Thanks, Susan and Lisa. Anyone else want to weigh in on this one? It's interesting noticing in the chat all throughout this meeting, I think, is the variety of people who have used the current Whois for uses that are being described. So certainly we have a lot of people in the working group using them this way. That doesn't mean that we will decide that they should be valid uses or not. We'll discuss that later. But good to see the level of experience on these things. So if there's no more discussion on this use case, my understanding from the chat is that Elaine Pruis had to leave the call, so we can't go to the next one and probably don't have time to do another one anyway, because we want to talk a little bit about how to complete our discussion of use cases. Let me ask for some information from Lisa or Marika, first of all, in the sense that I know we have the use cases that Rod presented and that Michaela presented that we never really discussed. I don't know if there's interest in discussing those at a future meeting or not. We can talk about that now. But also a question for Lisa and Marika. Do we have any more use cases that have been delivered that we haven't discussed yet, excluding the ones from Rod and Michaela that we did kind of as an introductory topic for this particular function? Lisa, go ahead.
Thanks, Chuck. Yes, we do still have a couple of use cases coming in. We do have the one from Elaine Pruis that's already been submitted, and we also have cases promised by Jeff Noakes, Javi Boss, sorry if I if I mispronounced your name, Vicky Scheckler, and Rod Rasmussen. So we have basically another four or five cases coming in within the next week. After that, however, the one question that I think is worth raising to this group is whether this group feels like we've covered a representative set of cases. I had one question from someone on the working group this week about, well, what about all the EWG use cases? Aren't they still there? We can still use them. And that is absolutely correct. They will always be there for this group to use. when and if those cases come, or, you know, the potential uses of beta come up in discussions as this group enters deliberation. But the benefit of the use cases, as we've seen, is actually talking through them as part of preparation and understanding the broad spectrum of how who is used today. So if anyone feels that something on that list has not been discussed and would like to actually bring that case forward for this group to review before we wrap up discussion of use cases, that would be the time to do that.
Thanks, Lisa. I appreciate that. So one action item for you or for Marika, if we could reach out to those that have promised use cases and find out two things. Number one, can they deliver it by the end of this week? And secondly, will they be able to be on the call next week to provide an overview and respond to questions and discussion that will occur on that? Secondly, I want to call everyone's attention to the question that Lisa asked, and that is, are there any types of uses that maybe we should try and get a use case for? Now, keep in mind, we're not trying to get an exhaustive list of use cases, but we're trying to get a fairly representative sample of different uses just for discussion purposes and preparation for our deliberation. So let me open it up right now to anyone with regard to whether or not they think there is a particular type of use that we would benefit from having a discussion on a use case. Can anyone identify any of those? I would appreciate you doing so now or on our list in the next day or two if you think that there is one that maybe would be good to cover. And I'll just pause for a little bit. Lisa, is that an old hand or a new one? Okay, thanks. Okay. Well, again, so we have a few more, and the agenda for our next meeting will be determined by the receipt of the pending use cases that people have promised to write. But also, is there any value in discussing further the use cases that Rod and Michaela went over as a kind of a precursor to our discussion of use cases? If anybody thinks that would be a good idea, please indicate that either in the chat or on the audibly. Raise your hand if you'd like to. I see Andrew mentioned consumer fraud as a possible gap. And so is there anyone who would be willing to write a use case on that one?
Sorry, Chuck, just to be clear, the consumer fraud that I was talking about is introduced by the use case that we talked about a few minutes ago. So I'm not actually suggesting that that is a gap that we haven't addressed.
Okay, sorry about that. In bouncing back and forth, I misread that. Sorry about that. Steve Metalis asked a question there. And if Lisa, can you quickly, or Marika, quickly go over the cases that Michaela and Rod discussed? Rod, you're on the call. Maybe you could just mention the ones that you shared with the group as a preliminary step on this particular part of our working group activity.
And Chuck, this is Lisa Pfeiffer. The list of draft example use cases is on the screen now. So Rod actually introduced a technical issue resolution example case about a month ago. Following that, Nikhaly gave four examples of domain name control use cases. But at the time, we weren't prepared really to discuss. We were still learning what a use case was. But those were the five that you're referring to. They're on the screen now.
Thanks, Lisa. That's helpful. So you can take a look at those. If anybody would like to request discussion like we've done on the use cases today and last week on any of those from Rod or Michaela there at the top, please indicate so, and we'll put them on our list to discuss. Otherwise, we'll assume that no further discussion is needed at this time. Doesn't mean we can't discuss the issues that they raised up in the future, because we probably will. Pretty much guaranteed we will. All right. So I think that we're coming up to the end of our time and the end of our agenda. Is there anything else we need to cover? Now, please note that next week our call will be at the alternative time. Keep that in mind, and hopefully those of us who have benefited from more pleasant times for our meetings will still participate as much as we can, even when it's not so convenient, for the benefit of those who three or four times out of every month have to participate at very odd times. So remember that next week. Anything else we need to talk about before I adjourn the call? Thanks again for the great participation. It was impressive to see how many different people participated both audibly and in the chat. So thanks very much for that. And thanks again for all those who contributed the use cases to get the discussion going and for being responsive in the discussion. Have a good rest of the week, and I will adjourn the meeting now.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Chuck. Again, today's meeting has been adjourned. Operator, please stop the recordings and disconnect all remaining lines. Have a great rest of your day, everyone.